So my case is quite different from the case that you just heard, because that was all about money. The plaintiff here wanted his money to get it in the head. That's completely understandable. My case, I would argue, is much more serious and consequential. My client is doing 86 years in prison. He's not much older than any of you. He's doing 86 years in prison, and today, we're going to try to argue, I'm going to argue, that he should get a new trial. Now, I've raised three issues in my brief, but I'm only going to concentrate on the one issue, which is the motion to suppress. To give you a little background on what the motion to suppress is, you're basically stating that the cops or some other official authority violated your constitutional rights. And if they violated your constitutional rights and they got some incriminating evidence against you, then it should be suppressed and not used against you. A lot of people think that's an unfair rule, but it's been around for many, many years. It's the U.S. Supreme Court, and it's called suppression of the evidence, if you win. I'm going to get into the facts during my argument, but I just wanted to give you a brief background as to what I will be arguing. It will be the motion to suppress. I'm arguing that he was illegally stopped, detained, frisked for weapons, of which there were none, and that he was unlawfully arrested because the officer didn't have substantial reason or probable cause to arrest him in this case. So that's basically what I'm going to be focusing on, and I hope you enjoy it.
Thank you, Mr. Huff.
So as I stated, my name is Joseph Huff. My registration number is 34384. I am a public defender. I'm representing Jesus Jimenez Ayala. Now, I think it's important in any suppression issue that we're all on board with the facts, and I don't think any of the facts here are in dispute, but I think it's important that I go through the facts first, what the officer was told to look out for, what he found in my client, and then I'll get into the court's ruling and how that was erroneous and applying the law that we have. So first of all, this is about a home invasion. Deputy Larson, who stopped my client, frisked him, and eventually arrested him, was told, look out for Hispanic males wearing all black, speaking Spanish, running from the scene. Over an hour later and over a mile away, he encountered my client, Mr. Jimenez. Now, Mr. Jimenez was not an all black. Mr. Jimenez was not speaking Spanish. In fact, when the officer asked him, what are you doing out here? He answered him in English. He wasn't running. He wasn't in a group of other Hispanic males. He was by himself. And he gave a legitimate reason for why he was outside in the cold with just a shirt on. Now, the officer originally approached Mr. Jimenez in what we call a consensual encounter, which is fine, which means any officer can approach you for any reason and ask you questions. You have the right to leave that if you want, but this was started off as an initial, as a consensual encounter. He asked my client, hey buddy, you look a little bit strange out here in the cold weather. What are you doing? My client gave him a legitimate excuse. And instead of investigating that further, saying, well, you say you're visiting your sister. Where is she? Which address is she? Give me a little bit more background, getting more information from other officers. He didn't do that. He immediately started frisking my client. Now, Terry B. Ohio.
Sorry, Mr. Huff.
Yes, sir.
When you say he immediately frisked my client, wasn't he aware that there had been an officer involved shooting that had occurred that night?
He did, but under Terry v. Ohio, he has to have specific and articulable facts, reasonable suspicion, in other words, that that person standing in front of him is currently armed and dangerous. He might have had a hunch at that point that my client was involved. He might have had some sort of speculative suspicion, but there was no direct fact, no like definitive identity. Gun on my client, him running from the scene, him in a group of other Hispanic males, that gave that officer reason to believe that at that point when he had that consensual encounter that my client was armed and dangerous.
Let me paint it in a little bit different way, Mr. Huff. I mean, and I recognize you're advocating well. The facts, look at the facts this way. We know there's a home invasion. We know there are four Hispanic, young Hispanic males. We know that a couple of them fled from the scene. What the officer comes upon within, you know, range where the person could have gotten to even walking within an hour of the scene, he sees a young Hispanic man walking in a t-shirt in very, very cold weather in kind of odd circumstances. And he, you know, so young Hispanic man, yes, he's not wearing black, but he's dressed oddly. The circumstances strike him as strange. Why doesn't that, and we know a home invasion happened an hour before, within the range someone could have walked to where this young man was. Why doesn't that get you at least reasonable suspicion? Probable cause is a different issue. But why don't you have reasonable suspicion at least to inquire at that point?
I think he had absolute reason to inquire further. He had somewhat of a hunch that my client might have been involved in that point, at that point. But Terry v. Ohio is very clear. It says officers have a narrowly drawn authority to frisk or pat down when they have reason to believe that they are dealing with a currently armed and dangerous individual. He did not have enough at that point to believe that my client was armed and dangerous. In fact, he was trying to investigate my client's story. My client said, I stepped out for a cigarette, and instead of patting him down for weapons, he was looking for implements of smoking. He wasn't looking for weapons, and he pretty much admitted that on the witness stand. But look, even if for officer safety, general reasons, he had the right to pat him down and frisk him, fine. When he didn't find cigarette implements on my client, that just means my client has a shady story, or that there's a completely reasonable explanation for why he didn't have cigarette implements on him. He stepped outside, he smoked a cigarette, he threw it away. He doesn't have to have, just because what my client told the officer and what he has or does not have on his person does not mean that at that point the officer has probable cause to conduct an arrest in this case. So even if I grant reasonable suspicion, which I'm not willing to do because I don't think it's there, I clearly don't think it's there, there's just not enough here for probable cause. Had my client had a weapon on him that matched a weapon that was at the scene, had my client been panting, had my client been agitated, aggressive, confirmed some fact that could have only been known by the person who committed the home invasion, then I'd give it to you. But there's not a single definitive fact other than a hunch or a speculation and reasonable suspicion at best that my client had anything to do with that home invasion that was an hour earlier and over a mile away.
Mr. Huff, can I ask you?
Yes, sir.
We know that there were weapons found at the scene of the invasion, and in fact, some of the occupants of the home were threatened, correct?
Yes, sir.
And we also know that there was a shot, or at least one shot, fired at a police officer causing a wound, correct?
That's correct.
So does it make any difference that you have a situation where weapons have been used, have been fired, someone has been hurt? Doesn't that allow a police officer a little more leeway in trying to find the perpetrator of that particular act?
It certainly would lend to the fact that the person that he is looking for might be armed and dangerous, as opposed to the reporting of a crime where there was no gunfire. But that just goes back to the Terry frisk, stop and frisk. And I said, even if I grant you that he could do the Terry stop and frisk, he then immediately went from that to arrest without any other information, without any confirmation. He didn't ask my client, well, can we talk to your sister? Where is she? Let me confirm your story. He didn't do a show up. He didn't bring the victims by to do a show up. He didn't ask my client to accompany him down to the station to give a statement. He immediately put him into custody on what at best is reasonable suspicion.
And I may have my facts mixed up, but I apologize if I do. Did, at some point, did the officer call like the station?
He was directed to frisk the guy, or frisk my client, and arrest him.
And in that call, was there any evidence at the suppression hearing as to what the station house told him as to why they were asking to do that?
I don't believe so. The only thing that I recall from the record was that he asked my client, why are you out here? He said, I'm smoking. He patted him down. He's like, I don't find any implements of smoking. He radioed that in, and they said, okay, detain him. Arrest him. And then immediately took him down to the station.
Under the, there's a rule called the fellow officer rule.
Yes, sir.
And under that rule, if it's a combination of the knowledge of all officers involved in the investigation that you can consider in determining there's probable cause.
Yes, you can impute other officers' knowledge to Officer Larson, but all imputed knowledge that we know that came out at the suppression hearing did not amount to probable cause. There was very little talk about what other officers knew, other than that they told Larson they were Hispanic males, dressed in all black, running from the scene, and shots were fired. There's very little, if anything, that I'm aware of, any additional facts that pointed directly to my client as being one of the people involved in that home invasion.
Well, his attire was a little unusual too, right? In addition to it being extremely cold and him being in a t-shirt, there was also debris of some type or grease on one of his shoulders, right? And his shoes and his pants were wet up to the shins, and that would be unusual too.
It is unusual. It is suspicious. There is a hunch that something is amiss here, but a hunch, a suspicion, does not amount to probable cause. And that's my point, Your Honor, is that, yes, I don't blame this officer for contacting my client. I don't blame him for asking him, what are you doing here out on the street? Why are your pants wet? He didn't even ask those questions. He didn't even say, why are your pants appear to be wet? Why does there debris appear to be on your shirt? He just immediately went from that brief questioning about why are you outside to a Terry stop and frisk, and then immediately went into arrest. And without more information, that's just not allowable under the United States and Colorado constitutions. If there are no other questions at this time, I will save the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Kathy Hansen. I am an assistant attorney general. So in this case, I'm not the DA. I didn't try the case. But I am with the appellate unit of the criminal justice section of the AG's office, and our job is to defend criminal convictions in the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court and occasionally in the federal district courts. And so my job here is to explain to the court and hopefully persuade the court that the officer's conduct in this case was lawful, that the defendant was lawfully arrested, and as to the issue that's being raised, why the defendant shouldn't get a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hanson.
It's important. I'm sorry, Catherine Hansen appearing on behalf of the people in this matter, registration number 25464. Your Honor, I think it's important to look back and look at the standards of probable cause. Because what we have here is we have police citizen encounter that I believe has three different stages. The initial contact, I think the defendant concedes, was consensual. The officer simply pulled the car 15 to 25 feet away from where the defendant was walking. He did not block his egress. He did not use any sort of intimidating conduct or language. And he simply asked the defendant if he would talk with him. So at that point, certainly it's a consensual encounter. During that discussion, there was a pat-down, and I think the pat-down in this case, arguably, because there was no evidence that it was a consensual pat-down, arguably there was a seizure at that point. The seizure at that point was lawful because there was reasonable grounds to believe that the person that the defendant was, the officer was dealing with, was armed and dangerous. And after the pat-down, we agree that the only evidence that was obtained after the pat-down was an indication that the defendant's story about why he was out there was not likely true. So in putting those three different circumstances in their compartments, I'd like to go back and then and talk about probable cause, because I think in this case, I think there's more than enough evidence to justify a reasonable suspicion for any sort of detention and any sort of stop and frisk.
And Ms. Hansen, I think you're going the same place that I'm going in my question to you, deals with probable cause. Put for us the probable cause evidence in the very best light as you understand it.
Okay. There's quite a bit, and I'd like to remember that it's important when you're looking at this evidence to look at them in terms of these are objective facts and circumstances, but they're to be interpreted in the context of a reasonably cautious officer with due consideration to what he knows, his experience, his training, and reasonable inferences from those evidence. So I'm not going to talk just about the objective fact and circumstances, but the reasonable inferences from those facts and circumstances. The first is that there's evidence of a home invasion robbery. I don't think there's any question that there was probable cause to believe a crime had been committed. I don't think that's in dispute. So there was evidence of home invasion robbery that happened approximately an hour to an hour and a half before the defendant was contacted in the area where he reasonably could have been had he been involved. So you first have that. Then you have the fact that he did match the description of one of the perpetrators in the home invasion robbery in numerous important and key aspects. The first is he was a youthful Hispanic male. That was a description that was the same as described by the victims. That was what the officer observed. He was, the victims described the perpetrators as Spanish speaking. When the officer contacted and spoke with the defendant, he could tell that the defendant spoke broken English and that there was some discussion. He understood some Spanish himself, the officer did. And so there was some indication that we also have likely a Spanish speaking, perhaps not solely Spanish speaking, but a Spanish speaking suspect. There also, the clothing matched the description. And the defendant argues that the description was that they were wearing all black. I'd like to point this court to page 39, of the suppression hearing transcript. The description was not wearing all black, and I know this might sound like a non-important distinction, but I think it is important. It was that they were all wearing black. And so the idea is that they were all wearing black clothing. The defendant was wearing black pants. And so that is consistent with the description. The other description was they had fled on foot. The defendant was on foot. So we have a description of the home invaders' physical appearance and their conduct, the Spanish speaking, and also consistent with the fact that he was in the location where he would reasonably be expected to be found. He was wearing clothing that matched the description.
But there, and I know you're not finished with here, but I guess I'm troubled so far. There are a significant Hispanic population in Adams County. I mean, there's a whole lot of 20-some-odd-year-old Hispanic men probably wearing black pants walking the streets of Adams County. That's pretty troubling. To me, if that's your big, he matches the description, there's probably thousands of people who match that description. And when you stated the standard of probable cause, you have to show probable cause that the officer reasonably had a reason to believe this man committed that crime, right?
Correct.
Okay.
That's okay. As you anticipated, there's much more. So we have the defendant in a location matching the description in numerous key aspects. We also have certain aspects of the defendant's clothing that indicate and are consistent with someone who has fled a home invasion robbery on foot under the circumstances in which it occurred here. We have the defendant with a white t-shirt, which also could demonstrate why he was not wearing all black. The white t-shirt was stained, had some sort of road debris on that. Certainly, an officer is entitled to look at his experiences and reasonable inferences from those experiences. And the facts in this case suggested that the road debris was possibly caused by the fact that the defendant had been fleeing and perhaps had hidden under a car. As we certainly know now, not only had he hid it under a car, but so had Jose, one of the other co-defendants. I understand that those facts can't be considered, but a reasonable inference from the road debris and the grease on the shirt suggested that he had perhaps been hiding, which is consistent with someone who had fled a home invasion on foot. If he had fled in a car and he had road debris, it wouldn't mean the same thing, because we would think, why would he have road debris or grease on his shirt but just by getting in a car? Now, this indicated that he perhaps had been hiding on the ground, perhaps under a car.
You said the word perhaps about 600 times here. doesn't that just prove or establish that we're talking about a mere suspicion?
No, because probable cause is not beyond a reasonable doubt. We don't have to prove that each and every one of these individual facts dispositively in and of themselves establish probable cause. Our cases, Altman, Arvizu, the United States versus Arvizu, all talk about the totality of the circumstances. And so what you do is you take those facts, you look at them in and of themselves, you look at them in a relation to each other, and then you look at the whole, and you determine, based on those facts and the reasonable inferences from those facts, do they all constitute probable cause? So while some might be, perhaps he was the suspect because he was a young Hispanic male, that alone certainly not enough. I totally agree. Certainly there was not numerous other youthful Hispanic males matching this description wandering around in that area. In fact, I think it's the only person that the officer saw, and I think that's significant as well. So I think you have to take not only all of these facts that I'm describing, but it's important to take those reasonable inferences. And even if some of them suggest, this might suggest he's involved, this might suggest that he's involved, it's our argument that all of these together, with the reasonable inferences from those, are sufficient to establish probable cause. I'd like to go through a few more facts. Although Deputy Larson, I think he indicated he showed up at the scene, he was there to transport, and then he initially left because there were some reports of suspicious calls in the area, or people seeing suspicious people in the area. And while those did not pan out, I think that also indicated, and that area, I understand, was in the same general area that he eventually found the defendant, showed that other people had seen suspicious persons wandering around in that area. So while, again, not enough to show that this person was the person involved in and of itself, what this showed is that likely the person, or at least one of the four, or multiple, it wasn't quite clear how many, people were still in the area, and that they were still on foot. And I believe that these calls had come in, and it was less than 15 minutes from when Deputy Larson arrived at the scene to when he contacted the defendant. And so I think the fact that even other people had reported suspicious people in the area is important to consider as well. And then the last fact, I think, is also very, well, there's two additional facts. Looking back again at the clothing, the fact that in addition to the t-shirt and the road debris, I think that it's really important to look at the fact that the defendant had wet shoes, wet pants on the shins. And the officer did testify at the suppression hearing that there was no snow on the ground. And what that suggests is that this is a person who is not merely just walking down the street. If he was walking down the street and there's no snow on the ground, why would he be wet? And so again, this indicates a reasonable inference that he was in flight, that he had ran through perhaps a yard, because I believe there was snow, and some of it had snowed, but the officer said it wasn't on the ground. So I think this indicates he possibly ran through some yards. So again, we don't know for sure. Reasonable inference from these objective facts, the wet pants and the wet shoes, and also the fact that the defendant was out in a t-shirt at a very cold night. And again, the last fact being that when he told the officer he was out smoking a cigarette during the pat down, there was no evidence whatsoever of a cigarette or lighter or matches or anything. The defendant argues that the officer didn't ask him any questions about where his sister lived, what was he doing in the area, following up on the cigarettes, particularly after finding no cigarettes or lighter. But I'd like to point out, and it's kind of a difficult situation because on the one hand, we don't know, but we do have evidence in the record, I think in page 46 of the suppression hearing, there was clearly questions asked. The officer described asking him, where do you live? Where are you coming from? Things like that. Unfortunately, the answers to those questions are not in the record. So we can't use the defendant's explanations to establish probable cause, but I just bring it up because the defendant has essentially faulted the officer for not following up and in trying to make a better determination. He did, we just simply don't know what the defendant said. So presumably it wasn't anything particularly inculpatory or exculpatory.
Ms. Hanson, can I ask you I understand all the lists that you've given us, and I understand the argument about reasonable inferences. How do we balance in this probable cause on review when there, and maybe you'll agree, there might be reasonable inferences of some problem here, but the reasonable inferences may also be totally neutral, perfectly. You know, this was a young Hispanic man who liked to work on cars. He was out, went out for a smoke, as Mr. Huff said. He threw a cigarette. He had one cigarette and threw it away. Then there seems to me you could reason for perfectly innocent explanations for everything you said. And he walked through the yard when he did, so his pants got wet. So what? How do we balance that? I mean, do you have to just defer because the offer, if there's any reasonable inference that supports the officer, you have to say enough? Or if there are, an equal number of innocent inferences, we say it's not enough. Do you understand the question?
Yeah.
How do you balance this?
Well, I think this is why we have such a huge body of law in suppression cases. And throughout the country, there's thousands and probably hundreds of thousands of suppression cases. There is no bright line rule. The courts have specifically told us you have to look to the totality of the circumstances. We have the standard for probable cause, which certainly is not particularly specific. With any suppression issue, there's often a balancing of the information. There's certainly no case law that suggests, and the case law suggests the opposite, that you don't have to dispel every reasonable possibility of innocence. But I think the quote that I quoted in my brief from the People versus Flower case is helpful, and talks about probable cause being measured in terms of the probability similar to the factual and practical questions of everyday life upon which reasonable and prudent persons act. And I find it hard to believe that you couldn't have almost any regular citizen who didn't know the law walk in, look at the facts, and not say this guy was involved. And so I think under these circumstances, since that's not even the standard, it's not beyond a reasonable doubt. I think we do have very strong evidence that the defendant was involved in this case based on all of this information. But I think it does, the probable cause standard tells us to look at these in terms of everyday life. Is this something that would cause a reasonable and prudent officer to believe the defendant was involved in this crime? I think based on the totality of the circumstances, absolutely it was. Unless this court has any further questions, we'd ask that you affirm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sitting over there, I heard Ms. Hanson use a number of words repeatedly, and I think you pointed this out, Judge Gabriel. Possibly, maybe, perhaps. I want to remind this court that the burden is on the state to prove that this warrantless arrest took place pursuant to probable cause. And when you use words like possibly, maybe, perhaps, that is not specific, articulable facts that lead to probable cause. That is suspicion. That is a hunch. Will I concede that this was suspicious? Yes, absolutely this was suspicious. But did it rise to the level of probable cause? Absolutely not. And I think the trial court put it best. And I don't know if this court believes that it's bound because of de novo review to treat this like a factual finding or a finding of law, but the court said that my client was, quote, a suspicious individual in the general vicinity. I agree. The court said to some extent fit the description. I agree. Larson suspected that the individual might be involved in a home invasion and took him into custody and transported him to the Adams County Sheriff's Department. Might be involved in a home invasion. I think that sums it up. There was a hunch, there was a suspicion, but there was certainly not probable cause based upon the facts. And as Judge Gabriel pointed out, every fact that Ms. Hansen put forth that she tried to portray as highly incriminating has a completely innocuous reason too, that's equally plausible. Why didn't Officer Larson investigate further? When he saw the wet pants, why didn't he say, well, where did you get the wet pants? Oh, you went through a yard, your sister's yard? Well, show me your sister's yard. Is it snowing? Where did you get the road debris? Oh, you were working on a car. Show me the car you were working on. Do you mind taking me there? He didn't do any of that. He didn't do any of that. He patted my client down on less than reasonable suspicion, and then pursuant to orders from dispatch, arrested him without probable cause. Now, I want to spend a little bit of time talking about the remedy, because I know that oftentimes the court looks at motions to suppress, if they side with the defense, as being a windfall. But that's not what's going to happen in this case. If you suppress his statements and you suppress his DNA evidence, it will make the state's case substantially weaker, but they can still retry him. They can still get their pound of flesh, their 86 years that they want out of my client. They can still do that because they'll still have the co-defendant, presumably, to testify, who got 20 years, by the way, much, much less, when he had GSR on him and my client had none, gunshot residue. They can still get their pound of flesh here. It's not dispositive. It's not going to result in this case being dismissed. All we're asking for is that this case be tried constitutionally, that the Constitution be enforced. And how that pans out below is up to the jury. But I just want to make sure that this court realizes you are not giving us a windfall by granting our relief. You are merely making it more difficult for the prosecution to prove its case, but it could still prove its case. And you could still uphold the Constitution in allowing them to do that. And if there are no other questions, I'm finished. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your arguments this morning, counsel. This case will stand submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course.